Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, today I will begin a series of lectures on the Sutta Nipata. It's one of the books of the Pali Canon. And before I go into individual suttas, I will say a few words about the Sutta Nipata in general, as a collection. First, the Sutta Nipata is one of the books of the Pali Sutta Pitaka. The Sutta Pitaka is divided into five collections, which are called Nikayas or Agamas. The word Agama is also used in the Pali tradition. There are four main Nikayas, as most of you know. The Digha Nikaya, collection of long discourses. Majjhima Nikaya, collection of middle-length discourses. Saṅyutta Nikaya, collection of connected, topically connected discourses. Then there's the Anguttara Nikaya, collection of numerical discourses. And it seems that when the early ancient monks were collecting the Buddha's discourses into the Nikayas or Agamas, after they had collected them into these four main groups, there were a number of works which didn't fit conveniently into these four main groups, and the problem was what to do with them. And it seems that different Buddha schools handled this problem in different ways. In the Pali tradition, a separate Nikaya was created called the Kudaka Nikaya. The word Kudaka means little, minor. And originally, the Kudaka Nikaya contained a number of smaller works, such as works which consist mostly of verse. We have the Dhammapada, Udana Itivutaka, amongst them also the Sutta Nipata. Terigata, Terigata, these are the verses of the elder monks, the elder nuns. But in time, more and more works were composed and came to be added to the Kudaka Nikaya, the minor collection, until it swelled up and it became bigger than any of the other Nikayas. So to call it the small collection became something of a misnomer. So that's why maybe we have to now call it the miscellaneous collection. Okay, one of the works that found its way in the Pali tradition into the Kudaka Nikaya was the Sutta Nipata. And now the Sutta Nipata, as a collection, exists, to my knowledge, only in the Pali or Theravada tradition. However, the works that constitute the Sutta Nipata, at least some of them, are found in other traditions, the canonical works of other early schools of Buddhism, which indicates that the contents of the Sutta Nipata go back to the period before the sectarian divisions took place. The title Sutta Nipata means, the word Sutta means discourse, discourse of the Buddha. The word Nipata means a collection, a group, an assemblage. So Sutta Nipata means something like collection of discourses or the group of discourses. the Sutta Nipata is made up of five chapters. The chapters are called Vaggas. And now, to indicate something of the age of these Vaggas, some of the suttas in Samyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, Udana refer to two whole Vaggas of the Sutta Nipata as if they already existed as collections during the Buddha's lifetime. In fact, the Buddha himself refers to them. So apparently, two of these chapters, the two last chapters, the Attikavagga and the Parayana, had already existed as fixed groups of poems during the Buddha's lifetime, and there were monks, and in one case, a laywoman is mentioned as having memorized one of these collections. And so these were collections which were known and which were memorized, whole collections. And there are commentaries on these two oldest collections already included within the Pali Canon in the Kutaka Nikaya. These are those commentaries on these two chapters, two of these late additions to the Kutaka Nikaya, which helped to swell up its contents and make it quite a big Nikaya. Those commentaries are called the Nidesa. And we also find one of the early poems in the Sutta Nipata called the Kagavesana Sutta, the discourse on the horn of the rhinoceros. I think he uses the title Unicorn's Horn, which I don't particularly care for. This collection, that particular poem, is found in Sanskrit work. A Sanskrit version is included in a work of the Mahasanghikas called the Mahavastu. And very recently, a Prakrit version of that poem was found, coming probably from the Dharmaguptaka school, which was based in northwest India, using a type of Prakrit called Gandhari. It's now published, but its price is very high, something like $60 for a poem of a few pages. There's probably a lot of scholarly commentary. Okay, other poems of this collection, they must have counterparts. They must have been part of the common heritage of early Buddhism. Perhaps they have translations into Chinese which just did not get included into any of the main agamas, and so they might be included within the Chinese Tripitaka, Sutra Pitaka, as individual translations. Some of them exist already, they're known to exist in Tibetan translation, but just as individual translations. But the Theravadins collected all of these individual poems and put them together with those two all very old chapters, the Attikavagga, Parayanavagga, and made this work called the Sutta Nipata. Apparently this work was intended as a kind of handbook for monastics to have in order to learn the essentials of the Dhamma in a poetic form. And the Sutta Nipata is noteworthy because the contents are very ancient, very old. It's said that many of the poems go back to the very earliest period of Buddhism. And the contents, the themes, have quite a wide range. But we find several themes strike keep on recurring again and again. One main area which is dealt with is what I would call the lay ethics, the ethics of leading a life as a Buddhist householder. And we could, from this, we could say that the Sutta Nipata, some of these poems in the Sutta Nipata, are the nucleus for human-centric or humanistic Buddhism from the very early period, the we call the Shravakayana period. Another prominent theme of the Sutta Nipata poems is the emphasis on the very austere style of monastic life. Poems go back to the period even before, it seems, the Sangha was existing as a well-knit monastic community, where the emphasis was on solitary striving in deep contemplation. In the Atthakavagga, we find many poems dealing with the need to overcome attachment to views, opinions, standpoints. The idea that enlightenment is to be achieved by leaving behind all views and all clinging to conceptual knowledge, conceptual systems. So some scholars have located the origins, or at least the inspiration for the Madhyamaka philosophy, in some of these poems of the Atthakavagga. And then I think the most beautiful and most inspiring part of the, I would say not only the Sutta Nipata, but in my opinion, the whole Pali Canon, is the last book of the Sutta Nipata, the Parayana Vagga, in which 16 Brahmins travel all across, they've heard about the Buddha. They're coming from South India. They travel all across India to come to the Buddha and ask him very deep questions about the higher stages of practice and realization. And the Buddha answers them at very, very deep levels. Okay, now I don't intend to begin by going through the Sutta Nipata from beginning to end, but I've selected three suttas as a starting point. These three suttas are the Ratana Sutta, the Mahamangala Sutta, and the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And the reason why I've selected these suttas is because these three suttas are, you can call them, the nucleus of Buddhist text that informs the understanding of Buddhism throughout the world of Theravada Buddhism. These are the most popular texts in the Theravada Buddhist world. They form the special group of suttas that are recited almost on any formal occasion. Whenever there is a special ceremony, these suttas are recited. They're called the Paritta Suttas, which means protective discourses. And people in the Theravada Buddha's countries, lay people, especially lay women, all know these suttas by memory. And even little children will be brought up learning from the time they can speak, they are taught to memorize these suttas. And monks will always preach on these suttas in their sermons so that people will grow up absorbing the values, the ideals expressed through these three suttas. So these suttas provide, you call, the backbone of understanding, practice, and attitudes in the Theravada Buddhist world. And each of them has its own particular focus. The Ratana Sutta focuses upon the qualities, the outstanding characteristics of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. The Mahamangala Sutta, the discourse on great blessings, provides, we could call it, a map or guide to the ideal life from the very beginning point right to the highest attainment. And then the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the discourse on loving kindness, describes the ideal attitude towards other beings that a Buddhist practitioner should have. And we begin with the Ratana Sutta, the Jewels Discourse. And this discourse has a story behind it, the background story, which is described, narrated in the commentary to the sutta. The commentary comes from Acharya Buddhaghosa, who bases it on sources coming from a very early period. Now, I should mention that the Ratana Sutta, I think I mentioned this just before, has also, it is found, a version of the Ratana Sutta is found in the Mahavastu, a work of the Mahasanghikas. And so it's found both in a Sanskrit, Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit version and the Pali version. Okay, the background story takes place in the city called Vaisali. Vaisali was located on the northern side of the Ganges River. It was a very prosperous city, a city of very high standard of culture, very densely populated. The city was the capital of a republic, a republic belonging to the people called the Lichavis. And so the people of Vaisali were quite a proud, independent people. They were not the subjects of a king. And so they didn't have the kind of abject, servile attitude that subjects in a kingdom would have. But they were very independent, very self-sufficient. It was a very wealthy, affluent city, very high standard of culture, people had very cultivated aesthetic senses. We might call this almost like the Boston of India at that time. Though I don't know what Boston is like today, but maybe. But at the time when the Buddha was staying in Rajagaha, Rajgir, on the southern side of the Ganges River, a triple disaster struck Vaisali. First, in the countryside surrounding Vaisali, over a period of several months, the crops all fell. There was widespread famine broke out. And people started, because they couldn't get food, people became very thin and sickly, and then they started to die in increasing numbers. In almost every household, people were dying. Then because people were dying, the bodies started to decay. And again, this is according to the commentary, when the bodies were decaying, certain types of beings called Amanusa, non-human beings, these would be goblins or ghosts or ghouls, monsters, were attracted to the smell of the decaying flesh, and evil spirits, and they came and started to haunt the streets and households of Vaisali. And people were stricken with fear and terror because of these evil spirits. And then when the evil spirits came, perhaps in reality these might have been wild animals coming from the surrounding countryside to eat the corpses, but as it comes down in the commentary, they were evil spirits. Then when the evil spirits came, and also because of the decay of the body, then a plague broke out, and still more people were dying because of the plague. And so the Lichavis, the inhabitants of Vaisali, took counsel. They didn't know what to do, how to stop this triple disaster, famine, attack by evil spirits, and the plague. Then some of them heard that in Rajgir, Rajagaha, an enlightened being had appeared, who they called the ascetic Gotama, the Buddha. And they said that he was very powerful, endowed with great compassion, great majestic spiritual power, and had the great capacity of blessings. And they thought, maybe we can invite the Buddha here and ask him to do something to relieve us of our misery. And so a group of the Lichavis went across the Ganges and came to the bamboo grove where the Buddha was staying. And they invited the Buddha to come to Vaisali. The Buddha told them that he was staying at the bamboo grove on the invitation of King Bimbisara, and that they would have to get permission from the king. And so the Lichavis went to the king, asked him for permission, and King Bimbisara not only agreed, but with all of his workers, he paved the road from the bamboo grove. Not, he didn't pave it, but he prepared the road from the bamboo grove to the bank of the river Ganges to make it smooth and easy to travel. And then the Buddha, surrounded by 500 monks, walked from the bamboo grove to the bank of the Ganges River. The king provided boats to carry them across. When they came to the other side of the Ganges River, the Lichavis had prepared the road leading from the Ganges to Vaisali. When the Buddha reached the outer gate of Vaisali, he took his alms bowl and gave it to Venerable Ananda and said to Ananda, "Fill this alms bowl with water. I'm going to teach you a sutta. When you hear the sutta from me, you learn it by memory." And Ananda could remember anything he heard just one time. "Then you wander around the streets of Vaisali with this bowl of water and taking a brush and brushing the water over the streets of Vaisali, reciting the sutta." Ananda received these instructions from the Buddha and did as the Buddha said. And as he wandered around the streets, reciting the sutta, spreading the water, the ghosts, the demons, all fled because of the spiritual power of the sutta. Then meanwhile, the Buddha was conducted to the town hall, the center of the town, center of the city. He went there together with the group of monks, the community of monks. They were all sitting silently. And meanwhile, the devas, the gods from many of the world systems, knew that a great event was taking place. So they all congregated from many world systems, all led by Saka, the king of the gods. They were all gathered above the city of Vaisali. And the Buddha came to the city, came to the hall, sat down, the monks all sat, all waiting for Ananda to return. Ananda came, took his seat close to the Buddha. Then the Buddha recited to the whole assembly the Ratna Sutta again. And when the Buddha recited it, then through the power of his recitation, a kind of blessing of protection was extended over the city of Vaisali. And then people were cured of their illness, and the famine passed, was finished, and the Vaisalis all came to embrace the teaching of the Buddha. And Vaisali then became a very strong, a stronghold for Buddhism. Okay, so this is the background story to the sutta. And now we come to the text of the sutta itself. And I assume you should have the book. But I will read, and anyway, I'll read the verses first in Pali. Then I will read the translation and then give explanation. And I like to recite the Pali in traditional style. My own traditional style. Nobody else's. Okay, the first verse.
Yani da bhutani samagatani bhumani vayani vantalike sabeva bhuta sumana bhavantu atopi sakacha sunantu basitam.
The first verse is an invocation to the spirits. And I read the translation. Whatever beings are assembled here, whether terrestrial or celestial, let all such beings be happy. Let them, moreover, attentively listen to what is said. Okay, so this is the invocation or invitation to the spirits. In this case, according to the commentary, the Buddha is addressing all the spirits who might be witnessing that assembly at Vaisali. And the spirits are said to be of two types. Yanida bhutani samagatani bhumani. That's the terrestrial spirits, spirits dwelling close to the earth. Bhumani vayani vantalike. Or those dwelling in the sky, celestial spirits. According to the commentary, the Buddha is addressing all spirits, including the devas from, or gods from all the different deva realms, right up to the highest deva realms. But in my view, the Buddha's address is primarily to those beings close to the human realm, who are of two primary classes, those who dwell very close to the earth, close proximity to the earth. Dwelling in trees, fields, forests. And there are devas and other beings dwelling above the earth, but in close relationship to the human realm. Not so much the devas and the higher heavenly realms don't have too much concern with events taking place in the human world. but there are devas dwelling in lower heavenly realms, or even in realms just above the earthly realm, the human realm, who can witness events taking place here. I know that this way of speaking doesn't click very readily with those brought up on so-called scientific education, and I don't know what I can do to convince you of the existence of these spirits. But I just have to say that if you were to, okay, in 1985, a friend of mine told me that there was a machine that you can be in, this was taking place in Sri Lanka. You could be in Sri Lanka, you'd have this machine, you take a letter that you've just written, you put it over this machine, you press a button, and you have a friend in America, and he'll get a copy of that letter just in the snap of a finger, exactly in your handwriting. And I said to him, come on, man. You're pulling my leg. I mean, let's face it. We have scientific educations. You can't fool me. And he said, I'm not fooling you. Such a thing exists. They call it a fix machine. And I said, I believe it when I see it. Okay. So now I've seen it. Okay, so there are many things that we can't see with our own eyes. And because we can't see them, doesn't mean that they don't exist. If we have the eyes, this was called the divine eye, then we would be able to see them. And one reason why we don't have much contact with the devas here, I have to tell you, is because they have fled from America. The reason they fled is because there's too much noise, too much heavy technology, too much pollution. And people don't believe in them. Because people don't believe in them, they don't treat them in the proper way. And when people don't treat them in the proper way, then there's no reason for the devas to stay around. Devas depend upon close contact with human beings. But if one, in very traditional societies where people live very simple lives and have very virtuous lives, and people recognize the existence of devas and make offerings to the devas, then the devas respond to these offerings. And then the devas come into close contact with those human beings and can help them in various ways. Okay, then the next phrase says, let all such beings be happy. Sumana bhavantu. So this is the Buddha now, at the very beginning of the sutta, he's extending the thought of loving kindness, of metta, to the beings, the devas and the other spirits. And this is leading up to the purpose of the sutta, which is going to be, I have it listed here, to ward off danger and to bestow safety and blessings. And the means of doing this will be by making determinations of truth based on the three jewels. The triple gem. And I will explain what that is meant a little later. Okay, after telling the beings to be happy, the Buddha ask them to listen attentively to what he's going to say. And then he comes now to the second verse. Again, I recite the Pali. Tasma hi bhuta nisameta sabbe metang karota manusya pajaya divacharato cha haranti ye balin tasma hi nerakata apamata. Okay, then the English translation. Therefore, O beings, do you all pay attention? Diffuse loving kindness towards humankind who day and night bring offerings to you. Protect them, therefore, with earnestness, or be diligent in protecting them. Okay, here the Buddha is giving instructions to the spirits. First, he tells them, pay attention to what I am saying. And then he instructs them, asks them to extend loving kindness, to be helpful to human beings. And the reason they should be helpful to human beings is because human beings make offerings to the spirits and to the devas. The word, the Pali word here is bali, which in a traditional Indian society means that in a traditional village or town there will be shrines to the devas, and people will come when they prepare meals for themselves. Always they will take the first portion of food and offer it to the devas. They will take flowers and incense and offer to the devas. But the kind of special offering that is the Buddha instructs his followers to make to the devas and to the spirits is not the offering of material things, but the offering of merits. We call this sharing of punya. So whenever one does meritorious deeds in the course of the day, one should always share the merits of those deeds with the devas, the divine beings, and the buddhas. Those are the spirits which are sometimes violent, but they can be helpful if one shares merits with them. And this creates what you call the ideal relationship between the beings in the human realm and those in the other realms of existence, the relationship of mutual help. Here in the human realm, we have not even mutual help between human beings, but rather so much violence, destruction, pointless killing and bloodshed. But a follower of the Buddha Dhamma does virtuous, meritorious deeds, and then every day, at least once a day, before going to bed, or sometime in the evening, one should just reflect on those meritorious deeds, and then share the merits with the devas and the buddhas, the spirits. And that way, the devas and spirits come to feel special affection for one, even if one doesn't see them. But one can feel their presence sometimes quite tangibly. I have to say, on a personal note, I have never seen any devas, any Buddhas, but I've had the great fortune. I live for 17 years in a forest, which was just above one of the spiritually most powerful places on earth, the place where the Buddha's tooth relic is kept. And I'm sure that there are many, many devas who come to venerate the Buddha's tooth relic in the night, the middle of the night. And their presence can be felt in the forest where I was staying. Though I don't see them or actually tangibly have any kind of sense of their existence. Okay, I thought I would cover more, but I do want to get verse 3, at least, to get into the substance of the sutta. The first verse. Okay, this is the verse. Now, we've completed the two introductory verses. Now we come into called the essence of the sutta. And this is going to be establishing a basis for warding off danger, bestowing safety and blessings based upon or by forming determinations of truth based on the three jewels. And we begin with the first jewel, the Buddha. Yang kin jivitang idava hurangva sage suvayang ratanang panitang nano samangati tathagatena idampi bhute ratanang panitang etena satchena suati hotu. Okay, the text says, whatever treasure there be, either here or in the other world, or whatever precious jewel is in the heavenly worlds, there is none comparable with the Tathagata. This precious jewel is in the Buddha. By this truth may there be. Actually, it should be, by this truth may there be safety. Peace is not quite accurate. By this truth may there be safety. Okay, so here the verse refers to the Buddha under his designation, Tathagata. And so I give in the notes some explanation of this word. First, I give an explanation based upon a quotation from the Anguttara Nikaya. What is the meaning of the Tathagata, the word Tathagata? This is the designation that the Buddha uses most often to refer to himself. And there's one sutta where the Buddha gives a number of explanations of this word. He says, one is that he has fully awakened to the nature of this world, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. Therefore, he is called the Tathagata. Then he says, whatever in this world is seen, heard, sensed, known, cognized, thought, sought after with the mind, all that is he has fully awakened to. Just as it is, therefore, he is called the Tathagata. Then the third explanation says, from the time of his enlightenment to the time of his passing away, everything that he speaks is just so, just correct. Therefore, he is called Tathagata. Another explanation says that his actions are in accordance with his words. His words are in accordance with his actions. Therefore, he is called the Tathagata. Then the fifth explanation says that in this world, he is the one who is unvanquished, the vanquisher, the one who is the universal seer, the wielder of power. Therefore, he is called the Tathagata. So those are explanations that come from the suttas. Then the commentaries give further explanations of the word Tathagata. Again, they try to draw out every little strain, every little ounce of meaning from the word. And they derive the word Tathagata. The original meaning is not really known precisely, but they take it, in one sense it could be taken, Tathagata, one who is thus come. Why has he thus come? He's thus come because he has come in the same way that all the other Buddhas of the past have come. That is, he has come by fulfilling the 10 perfections, the 10 paramis, by making the great sacrifices that all the Buddhas make, sacrifice of body, of organs, of property, of possessions, by acting for the welfare of the world in so many different ways. Okay, so that's one sense of Tathagata. Another derivation, he is thus gone, breaking up the compound in a different way, Tathagata. He is gone thus gone. That is, he is gone to nirvana, gone to the unconditioned. How is he gone there? By practicing the 10 perfections, by fulfilling the 37 aids to enlightenment, the 4 foundations of mindfulness, 4 right efforts, all the ways through to the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so these are different ways of taking the meaning of Tathagata. And then it's said that the Tathagata is that nothing is comparable to the Tathagata. No treasure in this world, in any other world, not even the precious jewels in the heavenly worlds. And then the commentary describes that in the heavenly worlds there are so many precious jewels. If you think you have big diamonds in this world, you have to guess again, because in the heavenly worlds, the diamonds are much bigger, brighter, more beautiful. So many jewels of different colors, different shapes, different facets, but none of them compare to the Tathagata, who is the true jewel. And so for this reason, it's said that this precious jewel, itampi buddhe ratanang panitang, this precious jewel is in the Buddha. So it's the qualities of the Buddhahood, you say Buddhahood itself, that is the precious jewel. And here the meaning of jewel is whatever, something that is rare, something considered precious, something difficult to find, difficult to see, something that gives people delight when one looks at a beautiful jewel, even if one can't purchase it, can't own it, but it gives delight to the mind. And something, there's a belief in India that there's a jewel that fulfills all of one's wishes called Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling gem. So that is the ideal jewel. And so these are all connotations, suggested meanings of the word jewel. And so the Buddha is considered the supreme jewel because he appears very rarely, very difficult to see. He's very precious. He gives delight. He is cherished by all beings who see him. And he fulfills all of one's deepest wishes. And then one concludes the verse by this, what is called the determination of truth. And this is a very important point. Etena sacena buddhe ratanam panitam. Etena sacena suvati hotu. Now what one is doing when one recites the verse, one is directing one's mind first to the meaning of the words, and through the meaning of words, connecting one's minds to the qualities of the Buddha jewel. And so one is drawing into one's mind the spiritual power, what is called the anubhava of the Buddha, the spiritual power which derives from the Buddha's fulfillment of the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections over incalculable world cycles, countless aeons. His fulfillment of the 37 aids to enlightenment over countless lives. Was bringing to mind his fulfillment of so many virtues, the great omniscient knowledge, the great compassion, the 10 powers of Tathagata, the 4 grounds of self-confidence. All the different facets of the Buddha's knowledge, wisdom, compassion, and channeling them through one's mind and placing trust, confidence, devotion, trust and confidence in those qualities, devotion towards the Buddha as the embodiment of those qualities. And then through the power of mind generated by that thought, by that recitation, one makes a determination of truth, what is called satya vachana or satya vacha, saying, etena sacena suvati hotu, with a thought of loving kindness and compassion, one is wishing for the welfare, happiness, safety, security, and well-being of others. And so one's own mind becomes a kind of channel for the great blessing power of the Buddha jewel. And through the power of that mind, one radiates and extends thoughts of loving kindness, compassion through those words to others, wishing for their safety and security. And that is called a determination of truth. And of course, at the beginning, maybe the determination doesn't have much power, but as one goes on practicing this and cultivating a life of Dhamma, a life based upon the qualities of Dhamma, then one's power of determination increases and increases, till, as in the case of the Buddha, when he comes to Vaisali, he can make that resolution, determination, and then all of the evil spirits will flee away, and famine will be terminated, and people will enjoy peace and prosperity again. But it doesn't amount to any kind of omniscient power, because even the power of a Buddha is limited by conditions in the world. Okay, that should be our talk. And I think the way we do it, if there are questions, then I'll take questions up to about 2 o'clock. Please feel welcome to ask questions. Don't be shy. Yeah, I thought I would get into three verses today. I thought I would get to verse 5 today.
It's, according to your explanation, is this as a kind of way of meditation on the Buddha?
It's not actually a meditation on the Buddha.
A way of a meditation on the Buddha.
A way of meditation on the Buddha. It's not actually a meditation on the Buddha.
I mean now the verse 3.
Yeah.
Take on the Buddha's virtue.
Yeah. It's not a formal method of meditation on the Buddha. Though one is directing one's mind to the qualities of the Buddha, and then through the recitation, then one is, as I said, one is by directing one's mind to the qualities of the Buddha, one is sort of drawing upon those qualities as a source of power, and then reciting the determination of truth. But it's not the same as doing the recollection of the Buddha meditation, in which one would be sitting, usually sitting, and then systematically going through qualities of the Buddha again and again, and then developing them in a particular pattern over and over. So looked at from the standpoint of just states of consciousness, the very fact that one is directing the mind to the qualities of the Buddha and focusing the mind on those qualities, even momentarily, makes it a kind of meditation on the Buddha, but it's not a sustained meditation on the qualities of the Buddha. Yeah.
Fante, you talk about this Ratana Sutra, and the Buddha declared only to the celestial beings and terrestrial beings, not the human beings. And the final the verse, may this truth, and by this truth may there be safety.
Yeah.
And is that the reason Buddha asked them to be assembled there and give some speech and wish them to protect the beings or do something? Because they are not human beings.
They're non-human beings. According to the commentarial account, human beings were present when the Buddha spoke the sutta, because there was this big assembly of all of the people from Vaisali were present. But the words of the sutta are addressed to the non-human beings. I would think these are the devas and the buddhas, because the Buddha is asking them to give protection to human beings. And then he's asking that there be safety. I think this is to allay, to ask those spirits that might have had harmful intentions towards human beings to instead protect them and be kind to them.
Okay, because each verse is after this, and always say, by this truth may there be safety.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the reason.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I have heard of an explanation from Metta Sutta. It was given by the Buddha to disciples who were troubled by devas in the forest.
Yeah.
Is that a reference to the Visali episode, or is that a different?
No, that's a completely different episode. I don't want to go into that now, because then I will pull the rug out from under my feet when I have to come to the Metta Sutta. Then I will give the background story to that.
You mentioned that by this truth may there be peace.
Yeah.
And I read from some other situations that people will make some wish, he will recite some truth.
Yeah.
Like Angulimala.
Angulimala, yeah. Yeah.
The Buddha taught him how to make a wish for some woman who had a difficulty.
Right, yeah, yeah.
By declaring the truth that he is observing precept of non-killing. And there are many cases, other stories, they had some wishes, but just declaring some truth or some merit that they had done in the past. Is it simply because of declaring some truth that they have the power of their wish to come true? And here, of course, it is based on the power of the Buddha. The power of Buddha is very strong and deep. Is it because of this?
It's supposed to come from the power of virtue, the accumulated power of virtue. The case of Angulimala, you know, Angulimala had been a serial killer. He had killed, according to the story, not close to 1,000 people. But then the Buddha met him and converted him and made him into a monk. And then one time when Angulimala went into the town on alms round, he saw a woman giving birth, undergoing a lot of suffering. It was a very difficult delivery. And I think the emerging fetus was stuck in the process. And Angulimala came back and reported that to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, you should go to her and declare that in my life I have never harmed another living, since my birth I have not harmed another living being. Then Angulimala said, but that would not be true. Then the Buddha said, what I mean is that since you have taken birth by an Aryan birth, you have never harmed another living being, since you have taken birth by a noble birth. And so then you might recite it in that way. Since I have been born by a noble birth, I have never harmed another living being. So then Angulimala went back to the woman, and then Buddha said, you recite that and then say, by the power of this truth, may you and your child be well and secure. So then Angulimala went back to the woman and he recited this verse. Since I have taken birth by a noble birth, I have never harmed another living being. By this truth, may you and your child be well and secure. And then the woman immediately gave birth without any problem. Yeah. But then there's another story, I mean, this is a legendary story, which shows that it's not only require a high degree of ordinary moral virtue to perform these wonders through a declaration of truth. This is an Indian story. I don't remember where it's from. But there was a great flood had come into a particular part of India, a city, and the river was swelling, 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 threatening to overflow the banks and to flood the whole city. The king had called a number of the wise men to come, you know, the sages come down from the mountains, the caves, to stop the flooding river. Each one would make their declaration of truth. but they weren't successful. Then some prostitute heard of this, and she came and made a declaration of truth, and the flooding stopped, the water subsided, and everybody was astonished and said, "How is this possible?" And then they came and they asked her, and then she said, "Since I have been in my profession, I have never distinguished between my customers, no matter what caste they come from, no matter what their physical appearance might be like, no matter how much money they might have, but I always treat them alike without any discrimination." And I use that as the basis of my determination of truth.